The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And just a quick note, this is an updated replay of an amazing chat I had with New York Times bestselling author, National Book Award winner, James McBride. His latest novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, was named Amazon's number one book of the year pick and Barnes & Noble's book of the year, among many other accolades for 2023. Congrats, James. Here is our chat.
But the truth is, you know, I'm a creative person and I've had to kind of, I didn't intentionally do it, but I basically just, you know, created my own career because I just decided I would sacrifice in order to do the things that I like to do. That's really what it is. You know, I always loved music. I grew up as a musician. I grew up in the church and playing gospel music and so forth. And then I moved into jazz. And then when I came to New York as a young guy and I was going to graduate school at Columbia, I could see that the future in music for me as a saxophonist was just grim. I mean, because there were so many great saxophonists who were better players than I, who practiced more and who really wanted to play the saxophone as a storytelling instrument. And that's how most creative stuff happens. You follow the muse, and after a while, the characters, they leap out the desk drawer, or they sit up, and then you follow them out the room, and if they're any good, they actually move out the room. And they get moving, and then plot starts to show itself.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. New York Times bestselling author and National Book Award winner James McBride spoke to me about eschewing literary fame, his friendship with Spike Lee, and his latest novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. James is a musician, screenwriter, and award-winning author of New York Times bestselling Oprah's Book Club selection, Deacon King Kong, the National Book Award winner, The Good Lord Bird, now a Showtime limited series starring Ethan Hawke, and the American classic, The Color of Water. His debut novel, Miracle at St. Anna, was turned into a 2008 film by Oscar-winning writer and director Spike Lee, with a script written by McBride. The author's latest novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, was an instant New York Times bestseller and named a must-read for the summer by New York Times, Washington Post, The Boston Globe, Time, Town & Country, and others. Described as a novel about small-town secrets and the people who keep them, it begins in 1972 when workers in Pottstown, Pennsylvania find a skeleton at the bottom of a well. The New York Times Book Review called the book a murder mystery locked inside a great American novel. James received a National Humanities Medal from President Obama for humanizing the complexities of discussing race in America. He's also a distinguished writer in residence at NYU. In this file, James and I discussed why he finds no joy in being well-known, how Color of Water changed his career, the lessons he learned from Michael Jackson, the hyperbole of the literary world and standing on the shoulders of giants, how we're all more alike than we are different, why writers must seek out their mentors, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Hey, man, thanks for taking the time to do this. I am honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. Of course, I have New York Times bestselling author and National Book Award winner and so much more, James McBride, joining us. Thanks for taking the time to do this. I cannot wait to just pick your brain about all things writing today.
Well, you know, I'm delighted to help if I can. I don't know. Well, I mean, we'll see how. I mean, I'm not as smart as people think, but, you know, whatever you say is, you know, I'll do my best, you know?
Sure. Well, you know, in truth, I mean, you seem very humble. And I know that you said your family's kind of getting a kick out of this this press junket. But yeah, what's the vibe over there? How are you feeling these days?
I'm all right. I mean, you know, this is part of the job that, you know, that I suppose you always hope will happen. And, you know, it's happened for me already. So I feel a little bit guilty about it, you know, because I know that there's a lot of other people who've written, a lot of great writers who deserve attention. But it's okay. I mean, I'm not complaining about it, you know. it's just, you know, well, you know, you just go with it. I mean, it's not, you know, you just do. I mean, look, when you, you know, there's not a lot of joy in being a well-known person, really. You know, it's because it means if you say something to somebody and it's wrong, they always remember you for saying that. And you don't want to be remembered that way. So it's just kind of the equivalent of like when you go out of your house, if you're talking to people who know books, you have to put on the mental equivalent of like a tux. You don't want to say, you know, where's my coffee? Or, you know, how come you didn't? Or, you know, well, that's dumb. You know, it doesn't makes you feel like a little bit in the spotlight too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you are no stranger to the spotlight. And, you know, I want to talk about this really fascinating career because, you know, it seems like if we can kind of wind the clock back as we do with so many authors, of course, you weren't always National Book Award winner James McBride. You weren't always shaking hands with President Obama and receiving a National Humanities Award, you know, but you're a sax man and you wanted to be a journalist and you've done all these fascinating things. You've hung out with Spike Lee and written plays and screenplays for movies. So yeah, take us back and reminisce a little bit because it's a fascinating story. And I'm sure our listeners would just be kind of thrilled to take a little trip down memory lane with you.
Well, I mean, I went to public schools in New York. I went to Oberlin and then I got a master's from Columbia and I worked as a journalist for 9 years and then I quit. And I worked as a musician for about 9 years. And then during that time, I wrote The Color of Water. And then from there, I've just basically written books and done as much music as I, you know, as my literary career would allow. But the truth is, you know, I'm a creative person and I've had to kind of, I mean, I didn't intentionally do it, but I basically just, you know, created my own career because I just decided I would sacrifice in order to do the things that I like to do. That's really what it is. You know, I always loved music. I grew up as a musician. I grew up in the church and playing gospel music and so forth. And then I moved into jazz. And then when I came to New York as a young guy and I was going to graduate school at Columbia, I could see that the future in music for me as a saxophonist was just grim. I mean, because there were so many great saxophonists who were better players than I, who practiced more and who really wanted to play the saxophone as a storytelling instrument. And I was always more of a composer. I never pushed, you know, that hard to get in line behind these great horn players who were in New York. You know, I came to New York about a year after Wynton Marsalis arrived and his brother Branford. These guys are, on another level, you know, Donald Harrison and Terrence Blanchard and all these guys. And anyway, but I could always write and I liked to write. And so I was into social change. I ended up working at the Wilmington News Journal as a government reporter, first as an intern, then as a government reporter. From there, I went to the Boston Globe, then the People Magazine, and then from there to the Washington Post. And I quit that. I think I was just short of 30. And I moved back to New York and I just played music for a long time. And during that time, I wrote my first book. And then, you know, one book led to the next and to the next. And, you know, I wrote a couple screenplays and, you know, little of this TV a little bit. I mean, I've done a lot of stuff, but mostly I've just always been willing to sacrifice and work in order to do the things I like to do. I've always done what I like to do. When I say that, I mean, I've always supported myself, and in doing so, I had a lot of jobs and I had a lot of experiences that helped me, you know, and people who were helpful. I never followed what everybody else was doing. I just followed what made me happy, I suppose.
Yeah. Were you ever kind of at a place, I guess, maybe after, the reception of your debut novel, were you ever at a place, you know, kind of as things progressed and you became more, as you mentioned, you know, just kind of more well-known and, you know, people want a piece of that, I guess, but, you know, which, you know, hanging out with guys like Spike Lee and making films and telling the stories of these great jazz musicians, were you ever just kind of in awe of, you know, just being able to kind of rub elbows with friends?
Well, I don't hang out with nobody. I mean, when I worked with Spike, you know, I worked, you know, he'd call, you know, when he did one of my books as a movie, I wrote the script, you know, I would write, you know, number of pages, we'd meet. And as soon as that meeting ended, you know, I went home. I never was a guy who hung out with anybody. But I like Spike and he's a friend and he's a talented cat and he's a very loyal person. And, you know, people really don't know him that well and make a lot of assumptions about him, but people who work with Spike respect him a lot. They adore him. And if you ever work with him, you would see why, because he is a very good person. He was well-raised and his family is very respected in Brooklyn. But I don't hang out with anybody. Spike moves in a world that's not mine. You know, whoever I work with him and the work is done. I put my hat on and leave.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I traveled with Michael Jackson when I was 26, I think I was. I was with People magazine, and I covered him exclusively for six months. I was the only reporter that he met with during that time, I think. And I saw what the business did to him and his family. I thought they were wonderful people. His mother is just a wonderful person. And I saw what Hollywood was like, you know. And I saw it like I was dropped into it. I literally went to work one morning. And I never liked working at People magazine, by the way. I couldn't stand it. But, you know, I needed the money. I needed to work. I was there maybe 2 or 3 weeks. I came into the office one day. They said, well, Michael Jackson's publicist is getting on the plane to go to California to, you know, get started for this giant tour. This is 1984. This is before the age of, you know, Beyonce and Taylor Swift with the $800, $11,000 tickets. But they were... the victory tour was a big deal. Anyway, they said, get on the plane. You know, go out there with the guy if you can and find out what's happening. And I said, okay. But I didn't have any money to get on the plane because I didn't even have a credit card. So all the editors, they pulled out cash out their pockets. I went to the airport. I bought a ticket and I got on the plane right next to the guy. I mean, in those days, you could do that, you know. And then I ended up just staying in California. I stayed out there 3 months. I never went home after that. I didn't come home for months because, amazing, you know, the story was hot and I was the guy who had developed access to the Jacksons and so forth. I didn't like it, but I did the job. You know, I didn't like Hollywood. I could see right away that it wasn't my world. You know, it just, I don't know how to describe it. You know, the first time I went to a rehearsal, Michael Jackson's rehearsal, I think it was called SIR. It was in a big studio out there. And I asked the guy, I walked in, I said, do you know what time it is? And the guy had a watch on. And he shook his hand as he looked at the watch and he shook his hand. He said, you know, David Bowie gave me this watch. And this damn thing just doesn't work right. And I said to myself, man, what kind of world is this, man? You know, but that's, you know, I didn't like it. And I, but you know, that was the job. So I just did it. But afterwards, you know, after seeing what happened to Michael and his family and how the stress and the struggles they were under from every side, you know, rich, poor, white, black, every struggle they could, you know, they went through that, you know, and seeing how that tour, I said, well, this is not the world for me. So I've never been a person who really liked that world or, you know, I mean, it's a, I mean, there are people in it who are wonderful and they're extremely competent. Some of them are brilliant, but I'm just, I'm not, I'm just, you know, I stay to who, what I know and who I am, which is just, you know, just, I guess, so as I just, I, you know, I want to be someone that helps people, I guess. I mean, I just, it's not my world. The whole thing of, you know, we're having lunch with the beautiful people, blah, blah, you know, the beautiful people are the teachers that teach our children and the librarians that stand up, you know, for the rights of authors to, you know, to create books that young people should read. Mm. Those are my heroes.
Yeah. 100%. Well, that's fascinating to hear you talk about it. And of course, you know, you seem very grounded and down to earth. And I think some people would call you a literary lion and at least a celebrity in your own right. Because, you know, I mean, I know LA Times has called you this decade's great American novelist. And do you feel like, you know, I mean, obviously hearing you talk about it, it doesn't really seem to stick to you. But do you feel like you'll leave a legacy behind that, you know, we can take some important notes away from?
And look, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, and Ralph Ellison, Toni Morrison, Joyce Carol Oates, those kinds of people have legacies. I don't know that I'm in that category, and I don't think it really matters that much to readers. I think what's important is that we, you know, that we as writers try to illuminate the world like so many writers before us have done. I mean, would that Herman Melville have lived to see how much joy and illumination he has given to people? I mean, I got a chance to thank E.L. Doctorow in person for his work, because I always just admired his work so much. He didn't get a chance to thank Heinrich von Kleist, who was a German writer who you can see influenced E.L. Doctorow so much, because that was, you know, von Kleist wrote many, you know, long before Doctorow lived. So I think that in the Black community, there's this saying, each one teach one, you know. You know, my job is to I stand on the shoulders of the writers who have come before me, whose job was to illuminate things for people. And so I don't, you know, some of this hyperbole in the literary world is not really, I don't know how to respond to it. I mean, I'm, you know, look, you're lucky when you can make a living as a writer, that, you know, or any creative arts, especially in the United States, which has so little respect for artists and for writers in particular, and composers, particularly American composers. If you can make a living at that, you are a very lucky person. So in that regard, I am very lucky. On the other hand, you know, I've worked very hard and, you know, and it's paid off for me. But no, I just hope that, you know, that, man, I don't even know how to respond to that. I mean, I don't pay attention to that kind of talk around my work, because one day you're the greatest thing in the world. And the next thing, there are always people who are, you know, you're on top one day, you're on the bottom rail the next. But again, the real heroes are people like Mrs. Alexander, who was a kid. I was a kindergarten, and Miss Abdullah, who was my second grade teacher. And they told my mother, oh, James, he is something. He's very smart. I don't know what to talk about, but I still remember my mother saying that. And I'm grateful to them. I mean, really, we've got to figure out what's important in our society. And what, you know, you can tell everything about a society, the way they treat children and old people. And the way we do both, there's some work to be done.
Well, it's an important message. And of course, you know, we have your latest, getting quite a bit of acclaim, and I know you're not listening to the noise right now, but you got a tour coming up for the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, which has got to be, is it exciting for you to get out and talk to people about the work, or is it exhausting?
Well, you know, I get a chance to thank people for you know, reading my books and for supporting writing and you know, the literary publishing industry. But no, it's not, you know, I've been touring for a long time, and I don't look forward to it, you know, flying airports and all that's involved. But it's nice to meet people and to, you know, to chat with them. You wish you had time to talk to. I often wonder when people come to readings and all that kind of stuff, like what they do and who, you know, where they live. Did they drive to get, did they take the bus, and you know, do they have kids? And, you know, does he have grandchildren? You know, does she have a motorcycle? I mean, I just wonder, you know, but all you can do is just say thank you very much. And most of the time people are very nice. Sometimes they bring a little bit of their mental baggage to your appearance, and then they'll raise their hand and say, how come you didn't, you know, why don't you do, you know, writers are not that powerful. I mean, you know, we just do the best we can. And so, look, when I wrote the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, I really, like with most books, I didn't really know what I was doing. I knew I wanted to write a book about a camp, about a camp director that ran a camp for disabled children, for lack of a better term, who really affected me a lot. And I wrote several chapters, and none of them were good except for the chapter that began with this Jewish theater owner named Moshe. Mm-hmm. And it was so funny. It was just, you could just feel his character, you know, surge into your body. And so I just discarded the rest of the stuff and followed Moshe into his world. And that really is how the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store was created. And that's how most creative stuff happens. You follow the muse, and after a while, the characters, they leap out the desk drawer, or they sit up, and then you follow them out the room. And if they're any good, they actually move out the room. And they get moving, and then plot starts to show itself.
Hmm. That's fascinating to hear you talk about your process. And yeah, I mean, when you're kind of in flow state, are you like a morning writer? Are you like, just, can you describe like a good period for you when you're like, as you mentioned, they're kind of, the characters are moving for you, and you're kind of channeling this thing. And you know, is there kind of an improvisation piece to it for you as well?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you get up, I get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock every morning when I'm writing, and hit it. In the case of the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, I spent a lot of time researching. I started researching that book back in 2008, 2009. Went to a mental hospital in Norristown, PA, and spent several months, you know, in and out of that place. The people were kind enough to let me in, you know, and I interviewed several people who were involved, and I read through cases, and then I stopped because I just wasn't, the book wasn't centered. There was no center. I didn't want to write about a mental hospital. It was too depressing and too difficult and too complicated. So I pushed into, you know, I think the Good Lord Bird came, and then Deacon King Kong, but I always had this other book that, you know, you're always pregnant. You always got two or three things in the hopper. So I finally, you know, came back to this and started pushing into the side of Jewish life that I've always been interested in ever since I wrote The Color of Water, learning about anti-Semitism in the South and the long and difficult journey of Jewish people in this country. And it just sort of came together. You know, I discovered Pottstown. There's a real Pottstown, and started learning about Jewish history early in the early 20th century here in the United States, so part of which I'd already learned because of my own mother, and my own Jewish mother was raised in the South. And it just, you know, these things start to come together, because what you come to understand after you've been living long enough is that we're all pretty much the same. You know, if you get in a room full of Irish people, they say, Irish are the funniest people in the world. And they are, man. They are funny. But then if you get in a room full of Italians, they say, oh, man, Italians are the funniest. And that's true, too. And Black folks will tell you the same thing. And don't get Dominicans started on what's funny. And God, there's nobody funnier than Jewish people. I mean, you know, because what connects us really is, you know, the human comedy. And so if as a writer, you find ways to connect us, to show us that we are much more alike than we are different, and you can make that connection, then you have a story. I mean, it's easy to make money showing how different we are. I mean, and that's really what some people in our society have decided, many politicians have decided to do. And they'll be punished for it after this life is over, I'm sure of it. When their time is up, when they try to check into heaven, if there is a heaven, and they try to check in, they'll find in their name is not on that short list. But for those of us who want the world to be good, to get better, we have to find ways to show how we are alike and celebrate that in a way that's not corny and saying, you know, like hold hands, we are the world type of, you know, you don't want to pretend it's like a TV commercial. But the truth is, you know, with so much negativity in the world, the miracle is that we managed to get along and love each other at all. Because the power brokers want us to, they like it when we go at each other, because they can sell more guns and butter and potato chips and whatever else they're selling. And then at the end of the day, go to the whatever religious affiliation they have and pray for forgiveness and claim that, you know, God has blessed them. I mean, come on, you know. So I don't buy into that bit of nonsense. I try to be honest about what really works. And what really works is that everybody wants the same thing. You know, they want peace. They don't want to be afraid. They want to have fun. And so that's what I try to do in my books, you know.
Powerful messages. And James, I know you have limited time here. We got to let you go here, which is sad. But we pray that you come back and chat with us again in the future. And as you have said yourself, love, humor, and kindness are the meat and vegetables of a good story. And fascinating storyteller you are. We appreciate you. Any one last final pearl to your fellow scribes on just how to keep going?
I forgot that now I feel bad because I feel like I'm talking about myself.
You've been great.
I think for young writers, they have to remember a couple of things. One is that the apprenticeship business that existed when I was young doesn't exist anymore, at least in newspapers and magazines. I mean, newspapers, because they aren't there are great newspapers that exist, but the avenues are tight because they you know, there are not as many newspapers, not as many small newspapers with these wonderfully gifted editors who helped. So young writers have to find, they have to find mentoring either outside of, either through academia or outside of academia. They have to find people who read their work, even if they have to just do writing groups. They have to write every day. They have to be, don't fall in love with your words, fall in love with your ideas. I'm not kidding when I said I wrote several chapters of the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store and I discarded all of them except for what now lives as chapter one with Moshe opening his theater to the great clarinetist. Everything else, every chapter of that book after chapter one is new. But the book was, I didn't title the book. So don't title the work. Just follow the characters and they will find the story and write consistently every single day. Even if nothing happens, just sit there and drink coffee. Because if an idea happens to come, you got a pen and paper or a computer in your hand. And don't write at a coffee shop, for God's sake. You're looking at somebody else. Go somewhere else and don't tell nobody nothing about what you're doing. And right when I wrote The Color of Water, I was in a Jimmy Scott's band. We were traveling by van and going all over. I never told anybody in the band I was writing the book. Because, you know, one negative word would bust my balloon. So I just did it. So just do it and just keep doing it. And at some point, if you're good and if you're dedicated, somebody will pay you for it. They might not pay you enough, or they might not pay you in the way that you want to get paid. But writing chooses you. You don't choose it. And since you're chosen, go with the choice.
That's amazing, Tim. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time, your verve, and your overall affect is really, really sweet to see and be around. But do come back in the future, and best of luck with the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.